and welcome to episode 148 of SMARTS, which, as you know, stands for Shot's Mother's Arrival Reveals Traumatizing Sacrifice.
Ooh.
Ooh. I am your host, Julia Guglia of internet fame, Dash Podcaster, and with me, as always, is Trevor, a.k.a. Rutiger Q Podcaster.
Hello.
Hi. Hey, so, do you have news for us?
I do.
Yay, unlike last week.
Prepare to receive my news.
Yay, news!
Okay, mm-hmm. So the only news we have this week is some DC movie news.
Uh-huh.
The Margot Robbie-helmed, maybe Gotham City Sirens, maybe Birds of Prey, depending on who's in it, but the female DC team-up movie that Harley Quinn will be headlining.
Okay.
Has a director.
No.
So it's Kathy Yan, I guess is how you'd pronounce it. So it's obviously a female director. Mm-hmm. Apparently Margot Robbie insisted that the project have a female director.
Nice.
Between this and Wonder Woman and New Gods, DC is kind of getting the reputation for having a lot of female headed movies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good trend.
About time.
She hasn't done a lot of wide renown. Apparently she's had some acclaimed indie movies mm-hmm. recently. That's pretty much it. But I mean, it's not like Marvel doesn't also tap relatively unknown directors and sure. make them into huge superstars. So
yep, true.
This could be another case of that happening. But it's an indication that this Birds of Prey or Gotham City Sirens or whatever it ends up being called movie is moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
The other big DC movie news this week is that DC has announced that they are developing a movie starring the World War II Aerial Squadron, the Blackhawks.
Okay.
And of all people, Steven Spielberg himself is in charge of the project. So his Entertainment mm-hmm. Studio is developing it, writing it, and he is producing it. And apparently the scuttlebutt is that he also hopes to have time to direct it himself, but that may or may not happen.
Right.
But it'll come from his brain trust, his studio.
Wow.
So Steven Spielberg himself is developing a Blackhawks movie. Nobody really saw that coming.
Nope.
Apparently he's been a fan of the Blackhawks for a long time. He's been trying to develop a Blackhawks project for decades now, and it's only now that he's finally gotten around to it. It's really only now that the DC has kind of become a known quantity as far as movies for any characters other than Superman or Batman. So, yeah. I mean, 30 years ago, I don't know how you would sell any studio on a Blackhawks movie, even if you were Steven Spielberg.
But right, yeah.
In this day and age of every comic under the sun getting a movie adaptation, it's perhaps less of a hard sell.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're DC and your movies have met with mediocre reception and Steven Spielberg comes to you and says he wants to do any of your characters as a movie, I think you pretty much say yes.
Right.
And yeah, so that's happening. I mean, it's probably years off at this point, but
right.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's really exciting.
And that's it for the news.
Cool. Awesome bit of news.
So I think we have the same comic of the week this week.
Action Comics.
Which is Action Comics number 1000.
1000. Yes.
So what were your... So this is the big, obviously, 1000th anniversary issue.
Yep.
Coming on the roughly 80th birthday of the release of the original Action Comics number 1.
Yep.
And it contains a couple of feature-length stories by the current writers of Action Comics and Superman, the outgoing writers of Action Comics and Superman, and then a bunch of shorter stories from various all-star creators. So what were your favorite stories in this issue? What were your top two or three?
The one I can't stop thinking about is the one where he goes back to Earth and he's talking to himself, and it's a desolate wasteland because apparently he has found a way to be immortal, and so he's visited the planet Earth as he does his good deeds, but he's over 5 billion years old, and it's the projected, you know, end of the world or whatever. Our sun is becoming a red giant. It's gonna get encompassed in the orbit, and it's the super far future. But he's visiting, and he's talking out loud as if he's visiting the graves of his parents, and he's saying stories about how he's fine and how Lois is still alive also, because she's taking some eternity serum, and apparently John is still around, and he thinks about them as he does his good works, and he's still appearing to be very much the same person. And it's just interesting to think of him being immortal and still continuing to do all the good things that he does. So that was a nice issue. That was very haunting. It was very hopeful at the same time, and it was very sincere and bittersweet, you know? So the planet is ending. He says, I could push it out of orbit, but somehow that feels wrong. It feels unnatural to do that because this is the natural order of things. And it wouldn't benefit anybody. I'm not saving anybody. It's been evacuated. It's just time to move forward, and it'll be the last visit that he has because the Earth is dying, like Krypton died. And that's another analogy that he made, that all of this time later, he still remembers it. So I think that's my favorite story out of that one. What about you?
I think the same one was probably my favorite. I'm a sucker for far future Superman stories where we see how much he hasn't changed, even though he's experienced all these incredible things and has lived for an inconceivably long amount of time. This is farther in the future even than the other example I'm about to recall, but it reminds me a lot of Grant Morrison's DC 1 Million thing, which took place in the 853rd century, I think. And there we see that Superman, or Superman Prime, as he's called then, because there's been so many other Supermans since then, his descendants, lived on Earth and did all sorts of incredible things for many, many years, but then finally went and lived in the sun for thousands of years. And so he's become inconceivably powerful because he's being fueled directly by the sun, and he comes out of the sun at a crucial moment to save humanity once more, and is reunited with Lois, who's reconstituted, and the universe creates a new version of Krypton and his parents and everything for him and Lois to live on as a reward for all of his heroism over the millennia and so on. And I always enjoy those sort of things where the character has almost become, and he's the only character in this short story, so there's not really a lot of how other people would view him after so long. But I like the idea that these characters survive for so long that they become almost like their own mythology, and how other people view them after all that time can be interesting. Here it's billions of years in the future, so it's far further than that.
Yep.
But he's really the only character. So I really enjoyed that one. I guess I think my second favorite was probably, I forget what it was called, but it was the one by Brad Meltzer and John Cassaday, where it takes place in just a few seconds, where he's racing to the other side of the city to stop a bullet, and he knows he'll be too late. And you see the scene of a woman about to be shot unfolding in slow motion as the bullet slowly leaves the gun, and he's speeding, past buildings and everything, and he can calculate, because of his many years of experience, that it'll be just a fraction of a second, a little too late, and then things happen. I really enjoyed that one. The final story in the issue was, of course, Brian Michael Bendis's first Superman story, and it gives a little bit of hint of what's going to happen in his Man of Steel miniseries, and then the ongoing series. I enjoyed that too, but I think that from what I've read of Bendis, it doesn't really give a great sampling of his work, because where he shines is really the character interactions and long-term character development. Like, I would liken him, not necessarily in terms of the complexity and erudition of his writing, but in terms of like the snappy banter, to kind of like an Aaron Sorkin or a Joss Whedon type. So, the quick, fast-paced, of course, it's only in comics, it's only as fast as you read it, but the quick back-and-forth banter between characters is sort of what he's known for. And this story was mostly a fight scene, so you don't really get a lot of that here.
Right.
But it brought up some interesting questions. You know, the major villain there has been, it's been in all the press materials and interviews and stuff, but the main villain that we're introduced to here claims to have been responsible for the destruction of Krypton, so it's going to go from there. I enjoyed it, and the Jim Lee art in that one was great too. The art in pretty much all of these was really good. They took an old Kurt Swan story that hadn't been published before, and Marv Wolfman did a new script over it, and they had a couple of modern artists
It was actually really cool because they
didn't, a new audience.
They never finished it, and they didn't really know what the original story was when they had when they dug this art up.
They might have still had the original script somewhere, but the edict was for Wolfman to write all new script just based on the art.
And the writer didn't know what the art was supposed to do. That's for darn sure.
Yeah, that's
probably
true. But
the person who was interviewing, because we watched DC All Access about it, and that's who mentioned it. Like, oh, we didn't even know what this was. It's just old Kurt Swan art that popped up and was in an unfinished state, and we didn't know where it was going with it or who was writing whatever. And so I got to work with that, he says. And I'm like, well, that's really cool. That's a neat idea.
I really enjoyed some of the others from different eras of Superman. So Jerry Ordway did a story, and Dan Jurgens, of course, did one of the the main stories, and Scott Snyder did a cool Superman and Lex Luthor story, and there were a few other ones in there. Yeah, so it was a really good issue. It's probably not my favorite Superman anniversary issue, because there's been a bunch of really good ones since I've been reading the character. I think it definitely lived up to its
hype.
Its, you know, milestone status. I think that they did a good job on it. Some of the big anniversary issues that I prefer are ones that are one long story, sometimes with little interludes by different creators, but it takes the opportunity to tell like an epic story that's oftentimes self-contained, but sometimes not, that really encompasses the history of the character, either retells the character's history from a new perspective and with a bunch of different artists doing art that represents the era that they worked on or something like that, you know, whereas this one's literally just a bunch of short stories. Yep. It's an anthology, which is no better or worse. It's just a question of taste. Yeah, but I really enjoyed it. And now, in a couple of weeks, the weekly Man of Steel miniseries by Bendis and an all-star line of creator starts. And then when that's over, Action comes back with 1001 and Superman relaunches from a new number one. And those will be both written by Bendis with art by a bunch of people.
Nice.
In June, because May is going to be all Man of Steel as a weekly series.
That's cool.
Yep.
It's very cool.
So should we move on to your pop quiz?
I'm ready.
So this week I'm going to be quizzing you about Superman anniversary issues.
I thought so.
So I will tell you the the issue number.
Oh, okay.
And I will give you a choice of three plots from the story.
Awesome.
And two of them are real and one of them is fake.
Awesome.
Okay?
Yes.
All right. So Action Comics number 100.
Okay.
The Action Comics number 100. A, feature a story about Congo Bill. B, feature Superman blowing out candles on a cake on the cover. Or C, have a Scotland Yard detective trying to deduce Superman's secret identity. Two of those is real, one of those is fake.
Let's see. I think issue 100 would not have been on an even year for him. I think that's just celebrating that. So let's see. Given that there are 365 days, so 52 weeks, so 2 years about to reach issue 100, he was not blowing out candles.
Okay. You're right, but I think there have been anniversary issues with the big round number where the character's blowing out candles, even though that doesn't make any logical sense, because it's the number of months, not the number of years, but sometimes that doesn't matter. But you are nonetheless right.
Yeah.
All right. Number two, Superman number 100. Did this feature A, Superman becoming a substitute teacher, B, a criminal figuring out Superman's secret identity and blackmailing him, or C, Lois Lane figuring out his secret identity for the first time?
I would say B.
No.
Okay.
It was C. Figuring out his secret identity.
Darn it, I should have said C.
That didn't happen in this one.
Oh, man. All right.
All right, number three.
Okay.
Action Comics number 300. Did this A, feature the classic For the Man Who Has Everything story,
ooh,
B, feature the classic Superman Under the Red Sun story, or C, feature Superman growing a beard?
Well, Superman Under the Red Sun. Superman Under the Red Sun actually did grow a beard, so I'm going to say that it must have not featured the A. A is my choice.
Correct.
Yay.
Very good.
Okay.
All right, number four, Superman number 400. Did this feature A, Superman traveling to the 60th century, B, introducing the holiday called Miracle Monday, or C, show what happened when what would happen if Superman grew up in the 21st century?
Ooh. Miracle Monday sounds fun. I'm going to say C.
I actually don't remember what the correct answer to this one is.
Oh, no. Live to tape, everybody.
I should have put a little notation. All of these three are real things, but I think I took one of them from Action 500 or something like that.
Oh, that's
I'll so have funny. To look it up later and get back to you.
So mean.
Quiz fail.
Okay, quiz
all right,
fail.
Number five.
Uh-huh.
Action Comics number 600.
Uh-huh.
Did this feature A, the first rebooted Superman story after Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Uh-huh.
Or B, Superman's first kiss with Wonder Woman? Or C, feature Superman facing off against Darkseid?
I think 600 issues is long enough for a reboot. So I'm going to say A.
No. This was a few years into the reboot. But in this issue, both Superman first kissed Wonder Woman for the first time and faced off against Darkseid.
So he did both those things?
Yes.
So not simultaneously. If I had answered B and C.
He was holding Wonder Woman with one arm and punching Darkseid with the other.
So if I had answered B or C, I would have been correct?
No, you're guessing the one that isn't real. Right? You were supposed to guess the one that isn't real, and you guessed the one that was real. But nevertheless, it was the correct answer, so I guess I have to give you a point.
Oh, sweet.
So you're pretty good. You got 3 out of 5, maybe 4 out of 5, depending on whether the question number 4, depending on what the correct answer to that one is.
Both of us really rocked this quiz.
This is not our finest hour. So awesome. we shall move on to our TV shows.
As is best now.
We're going to talk about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Krypton, Gotham, Supergirl, Flash, Black Lightning, and Arrow.
Yep. And here ye be warned. Spoilers.
Mm-hmm. So Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., mm-hmm. This was a very eventful episode.
Yes.
There was creepy stuff with General Talbot being brainwashed by Hydra. I thought that was all well done. I thought the way they got through it was clever. I like that Mac kind of says, I'm going to, tells the girl, come to me, I'll get you out of here, and then immediately pops back around the corner and ices him,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff with Ruby and, Baby Von Strucker there.
Yeah.
That was all really creepy and effective. Like, I didn't expect him to go out like that. I didn't expect her to go out like that.
Yep.
So now I guess we're left with the question, is this what was always going to happen? And now that, and it's something that her mother is going to do with the other 91% of the Gravitonium.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to cause the destruction of the Earth?
Right.
Or has this now averted the future? I guess, I guess we'll have to wait and see. So all that was effective. What do you think was going to happen with Ruby there? Did you think that she was going to go nuclear, or did you think that someone was going to kill her, or?
I didn't know what to expect. I actually, towards the end there, I did see it coming that that she was going to die, but I actually thought that her body was going to explode and split the Earth right there. I thought that that was the... I thought that was the
Earth
event.
Was going to be destroyed in this episode?
Yeah, I did.
I think odds are we're probably not going to see the Earth destroyed for real in the present of this show.
You don't think so? I do.
No, I mean, there's a little movie coming out in a week that you might have heard of that also has to take place on Earth.
Oh, right.
So that old chestnut. If only for that reason.
The funny thing is, I think of these two things.
Thanos shows up and he's like, I leave this planet for 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And look what you guys do to the place.
Yeah, just explodes. Stupid Chitauri.
How about my gems? Has anybody seen my gems? Somebody check the rubbish.
Yeah. Collect the debris. We've got to go sift it like an old-timey prospector. Can you imagine that? Yeah. That'd have to be a very big sieve. Anyway. Okay, I'm going to stop. You're not laughing. You should be laughing. It was a funny joke. Anyway, moving on.
Anything else to say about this one?
No, I just enjoyed it. The Fitzsimmons stuff was very heart-clenching because I thought for sure that somebody was going to start getting cut. Ruby is a very mean little thing. And then...
It was done effectively where you kind of hate her because... She's so entitled and petulant and murderous.
Mm-hmm.
But then
you pity her.
The show does a good job of reminding you that it's basically just because her mother
upbringing.
Raised her that way.
Yep.
But then it's kind of hard to hate the mother too because she loves her daughter in her way, and the actress that plays her very like soulfully. You know what I mean? She's not like a rigid military general type the way that Talbot was for the first couple of years. She seems like she's more emotionally available, even if she is just trying
and
to
her
trick you.
Her backstory was very good.
Yeah,
too.
Because so, like, we've seen her forced, backstory, right? Like it's all just. I mean, this is what happens with like a weird cult or an extremist group or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's just
layers.
Indoctrination happening generation after generation. You have to go back to the founder of the thing to know who to lay blame at the foot of. So Krypton, this one was called House of Zod. Mm. This one's really good too. So Lyta gets acquitted because her mother makes a deal with
the devil.
With Nyssa to join their revolution against the Voice of Rao.
Yep.
Get a lot of movement on the Brainiac front.
No.
Except we find out what's going on with Colin Salmon's fringe group or whatever they're called. We find out that he is from the future, presumably, because he's Lyta's son.
Yep.
I saw some articles refer to him as like General Zod now, but I mean, I guess it depends how long Kryptonian generations are, because this is supposed to be 200 years before Krypton explodes.
Exactly.
So is he the General Zod that knows Superman and fights him, even if he'd be like almost 200 years old, assuming Lyta gives birth to him in the next 20 or 30 years, he'd be like 170, 180 years old.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
Or is the Zod that we know, this guy's son or grandson or some cousin or, you know what I mean, nephew.
Right.
So I'm not quite sure if it's accurate to call him. I mean, he may be a general, and his last name is Zod, so I guess you could call him that. But when you call someone General Zod, you have a certain image in your head, you know? Yeah. Like, is Adam Strange going to meet this guy and be like, oh, crap, I know who he is, you know? Yeah, is it going to be?
No, I don't think so. I mean, my theory is that, my hypothesis is that that this is not the same Superman fighting Zod. That's...
He'd be good in that role, though. I think, like, he's got a certain imperious presence.
Imperious presence is one thing, but I don't think that he's not as menacing as Zod.
I think he could be. Like, from the last episode, the way he was interrogating Seg and killed that underling of his.
Yeah, that was stupid.
I definitely was getting a sense of that edge from him. I like the way they're writing the Zods so far because. It's in keeping with General Zod, like the General Zod's character, in a way, in that they're a house that is all about honor, but
above all else.
Well, but not above all else. Like, what you see here is that they will cast aside, like what Lyta's mother does, is she basically casts aside her honor for emotional reasons, right? Because she can't stand to lose her daughter.
Right.
So there, you get the sense that, and take that to its... you know, extension several generations down the line, you could well imagine a family that, I mean, you could make the analogy to like most Klingons, for example, where they claim to prize honor above all else, but they actually just have their own goals and they just sort of pay lip service to how honorable they are. I mean, General Zod in some versions is honorable in a way, in the sense that he's like, he's true to his word and sort of surface level.
Right.
Aspects of honor like that, but then he'll also, you know, kill innocent people and do all sorts of other things like that, right? So it's interesting that they're setting that. To me, like, I was looking at that, I could kind of see how that kind of behavior, if, you know, magnified by worsening circumstances and several generations removed, could lead to someone who comes from a very honorable house, but really just doesn't really understand what honor means anymore because the several generations before him have made too many mistakes and too many sacrifices, you know? I can see how you get there from here. I thought that was... Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I thought that was interesting. Much in the same way that you... And Seg is very much so far like a fairly standard leading man type. You know, he has his flaws. But you could look at him and see how you get to Superman much more easily because they're both sort of...
Yeah.
Straightforward, square-jawed, do-gooder type characters.
Yes, absolutely.
But the going from... her mother, whose name I can't remember right now, starts with a P, I know that. Or J, one or the other. Going from her mother and Lyta all the way to General Zod is a bit more of a stretch, like there's more of a gap there, but I can kind of see how you get there from here. So now it makes more sense, of course, that he knows... Well, that's the thing, though, is if he knows about Brainiac, maybe he is from our present, and then maybe he is the General Zod, right? Because if someone from 100 years ago... versus the present, wouldn't necessarily know. I mean, I guess they would know Brainiac by reputation if they lived through Kandor or their parents lived through Kandor getting taken away by
and
Brainiac.
It's definitely a General Zod mantra that he's trying to save Krypton and that he was very dedicated to protecting it. So that's in line with that, too. Yeah, it's an interesting theory. I still don't think that's... I can see the familial traits that lead to the composition that is General Zod, but I don't think that Lyta's son is General Zod.
Yeah, I mean, we'll probably find out, probably in the very next episode, we find out, like, when he says he's from. It's either, if it's 200 years from now, then it's him. If it's not, then it's not him.
Right.
I thought that the Seg's journey in this story was, in this episode, was sort of oddly circular in the sense that it starts with him escaping into the ice from Zod there, and he almost dies and he gets rescued by, I guess he finds the woman, he helps her out, and then she leads him to like these secret tunnels or whatever.
Right.
Where he finds this group that worships a different deity.
That was interesting.
And they don't trust him, and there's a big door there with his sigil on it. And then he escapes from them, ends up back in the frozen area,
Tundra,
and that's where he's found again by Zod, who brings him back to the same chair he was in at the end of the last episode.
Right.
So stuff happened in there, but it's sort of weird to end
the same way you got.
Like last episode, he was literally the same chair he was in. Yeah. Like it's kind of comical in a way. Like after all that, he's back in the same chair,
expressing the futility of life. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know where they're going with that. I really hope that at some point they get. I mean, there's not a lot in the comics that I'm aware of anyway about different aspects of like the Rao mythology, but I like what Greg Rucka did in the whole New Krypton arc from just before the New 52, where they got into like the Nightwing and the Flamebird mm-hmm. and what they represented. Like if I just, I want someone to say Nightwing on the show, I'd really enjoy that because I think I might've even talked about this once like years ago on the show, but the idea, I vaguely remember it now, but of course in the comics, Dick Grayson got the Nightwing name from the identity that Superman would assume when he'd shrink himself down into Kandor with Jimmy Olsen and fight crime in there.
Oh.
And then after the crisis, when Kandor didn't exist anymore, they retconned it as being like a Kryptonian legend that Superman had told to Dick Grayson when he was considering quitting being Robin. And it inspired him so much that he named himself after the hero from that story. And that's why he was nice. So they kept a Kryptonian link, but they sort of changed it a little bit. And then much more recently, they came up with the idea that the Nightwing and the Flamebird are like two, I'm not sure what you call them, lower gods or like angels or something, but they're the two forces. They're the Flamebird.
Like the light side and the dark side in Star Wars. The Flamebird
burns everything down. And the mm-hmm. Nightwing builds it back up again, like they're the forces of destruction and renewal.
But
not in like a good and evil kind of way. In the same way that like a forest fire is a natural destruction, and then the forest regrows, right? Like everything has to die and be reborn. And the Nightwing and the Flamebird are like the eternal circle of death and rebirth that keeps that happening in like the Rao cosmology.
Okay.
So I hope they get into all that. That'd be kind of cool. Mm. They could even have, I mean, if they wanted, they could even have like a vigilante running around in Kandor calling himself Nightwing, and that would actually be true to the canon. So I don't know if they're going to do that.
Hilarious.
Or, if Superman used to shrink himself down and fight crime in Kandor, we could have Segel putting on a mask and calling himself Nightwing and fighting the corruption in the government in
pretty
Kandor.
Pretty awesome.
So Gotham, this was a fun episode. So I don't know whether all the Ra's al Ghul stuff. I mean, first of all, was that? Do you think that was Alexander sitting under all that makeup? It sounded like his voice with a lot of effects applied to it. But do you think he was actually wearing all that makeup?
Yeah, I do.
Part of me wonders if he thought that if everybody
if they wasted all that time.
Part of me wonders if he and the people behind the camera agreed that it was a little beneath him. Because I think if it was really him under there, they would have made it look a bit more like him, like a desiccated Alexander.
You know Siddig. that wasn't makeup. That was what do you call it? That was CG.
Was it CG all mm-hmm. the time?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was because the
Maybe
way the
not
mouth
all
the way
time.
The mouth was barely moving when he was speaking, like that it was just sort of vaguely opening. Well, that tells me that it was like somebody either trying
puppeting?
Really hard to open his mouth under a lot of prosthetics, or like an animatronic thing that was, you know, like there was an actor
under there.
But the mouth was opening and closing with someone controlling it with a remote control off camera.
Right.
I don't think why would they have done it CG when they could just put him under like creepy zombie makeup?
I don't think they could get creepy zombie makeup to move that way.
No.
Not without a lot of money.
I bet you that was makeup.
I think CG is easier than makeup. Well, I don't know. Why don't we find out? Is there a way we can find out?
I don't know. But it's certainly not cheaper. If you put him in flowing robes and you're having him fight other characters and touch them and interact with them on screen, his robes are flowing everywhere. And like that's too...
No, I don't think the whole figure was CG.
Do you think just the face? Do you think it was just an actor with like a green mask on?
Exactly.
Eh, I suppose that's possible. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
Even if so, it'd be even less likely that it was him under there. I just feel like he got the deal of the century because he's had like 20 minutes of total screen time all season, and yet he gets paid to be a regular. So he's like, do you need me in this one? Do you put somebody else under a green mask?
Yeah.
I mean, he's super great in the scenes that he's in,
but
it just seems like it's so bizarre that they would use him so infrequently if you get him to sign on to your show. Maybe they're planning on doing even more with him next season, but it really feels like they've done just about all they can do.
He just accepted it as immortality, so I don't think he's going anywhere.
Yeah, but what else do you do with his character at this point?
Bother Bruce.
Just like show up periodically and just be like, hey, I still don't want you
What's
to kill
up,
me.
Hello, future detective. Yeah.
He called him Dark Knight, which is like, I don't know. You're really gilding the lily here.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. What did you think about the Selina
the barber
tug
stuff?
Of war, yeah. The tug of war that Selina has. How did you think that was handled?
I found it believable that she'd be torn in her, because she wasn't like, oh, I'm forever deciding my loyalties between Bruce and, right. and these women. She was, like she said, she was trying to protect Bruce from having to do something that he didn't want to do again, mm-hmm. and protect him from potentially being in a dangerous situation and all that stuff. Plus, she actually cares about what happens to Barbara and Tabitha. So
exactly. But, I think that I liked that Alfred, who has been a little wary of her, was the one to point out to Bruce that she's saying some logical points.
Well, Alfred is usually above all else a pragmatist when yeah. it comes to Bruce's safety. So if no matter who's speaking, if they're saying something that makes sense with regards to how to keep Bruce safe, he's usually gonna lend it some credence.
Yep.
Yeah. And all the stuff with Riddler, I didn't see it coming that he was betraying Penguin and Grundy there.
Mm-hmm.
It continues to be a bizarre path they're taking Leslie Tompkins down, but I mean, once you've had her infected with a crazy virus, then you can basically do whatever you want and mm-hmm. say that it's residual effects of the virus on her personality, right? So they basically have a get-out-of-jail-free card with her. Unlike with Barbara, where she just started suddenly acting crazy.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes that happens in real life, that people have mental issues that just suddenly
manifest.
You know, manifest, but at least here it was foreshadowed, I suppose, by that. And so it's like she's still trying to do good for the people of the Narrows, but she's willing to go further, I guess, to do it. So I mean, it's still within the same general vicinity of her character, but so Supergirl, mm-hmm. Supergirl is back. This one was called Shot Through the Heart, which I appreciate the pun.
I love it.
Yeah, this one was a lot of fun. I think that you know, Wynn hasn't gotten a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
He gets like a couple spotlight episodes this season, but mostly he's just there in the background to
support.
Sort of be goofy and funny and stuff like that.
It fits.
And it kept me on my toes, because I'm like, because you could well imagine the story ending with like
Shot's mother being
who mourns for Morn, right? Where it's like, oh, yeah. The toy man wasn't really dead. He just faked his death to manipulate
people. Yeah.
And then you're like, you suspect the mother a little bit because she seems like she's a little kooky sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you're like, is she in on it? And something weird's happening there. And ended up being like an acolyte of Toy Man's, who was like a mechanic that worked mm-hmm. in the prison that he taught. So I didn't see that coming, although it's not like that character was set up in any way earlier in the episode. So there's literally no way you could have seen it coming. But it wasn't really about that. It wasn't presenting into some grand mystery.
Right.
We find out that the reason why the Legion is here in the present, that that Saturn Girl and Brainy tricked Mon-El, because the threat that the World Killers pose, or one of the World Killers, right? It's the third World Killer, specifically mm-hmm. Pestilence, will become the threat Blight 1,000 years from now, that they're fighting, that the Legion was sort of formed to fight, or that is currently embroiled in fighting at the mm-hmm. very least in the future. And they knew that Mon-El wouldn't, they apparently don't have a lot of faith in Mon-El's ability to suck it up and do the job. If he thought that stopping an imminent threat to the 31st century isn't important enough to get to potentially have some awkward conversations with his ex.
Yeah.
But I can kind of see how a wife would want to spare her husband. But she's not really sparing him, right? Like, it's not that because he's going to have those. He's here, right? He's having those conversations. It's just she's sparing him knowing about it. She thought that he would actively shut the plan down if they told him about it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Which maybe speaks to how little she really knows him, I guess, or understands him. Because we found out before that it was kind of like almost an arranged marriage in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And they care about each other, but it's not like they got married because they were truly in love with each other necessarily. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's, I mean, I want to see more Legion stuff, and I do, the fact that they said that, oh, he has his Legion costume, but it got damaged or something.
Yeah.
Like, I like the fact that, I mean, maybe we talked about how a lot of the traditional Legion trappings aren't really on display here, aside from the rings and the names, but they kind of have that out, where they could just say, well, they have all their awesome Legion stuff in the future, it's just they didn't bring it, or it got damaged, or something mm-hmm. like that. Like, they all have these super awesome costumes, we're just not seeing them wear them because of reason X, Y, or Z, right? So you can still imagine Legion future is super awesome and colorful like in the comics. We're just probably never going to get to see it because, you know, budget, and also maybe extend the suspension of disbelief a little far.
Sure. What did you think of the cape magic that he employed to take down the dinosaur and then offered to
teach him? I thought
that was smart. I thought that was very clever, because it shows that he's had more experience. I mean, Mon-El's
never really been that kind of fighter, but...
Yeah, but it shows that he had accrued experiences as a crime fighter, such that he can now teach Kara a thing or two, you know. So that's a nice touch.
The last thing I guess is the stuff with Jean and his father, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really sad. I thought those. I mean, Carl Lumbly played those scenes really well. I was reading an interview with him and with the I don't think it was one of the showrunners. I think it was one of the writers, maybe the writer of this upcoming episode, where they're talking about how this next episode is going to really deal with a lot of that too. Ooh. And Carl Lumbly was talking about, you know, he was drawing from, like, his wife actually had similar problems, and she passed away a few years ago, and his wife went through something similar. And so he knows what it's like. And he's people working on the show also had similar experiences. And so they're able to draw from that. And, like, you don't want to burden your loved one, but at the same time, you really need their help. He took time off from acting to spend, like, every minute with her, because, you know, like, she wouldn't even necessarily have wanted him to. Like, she wanted to live his life, but he's like, no, we need to make every moment precious now, and all this stuff. So
I had no idea.
I like him so much because, I mean, he'll always be the definitive version of the character for me, mm-hmm. from the Justice League animated series, and still, you know, periodically voices him for video games or other one-off cartoon projects and stuff, much like Kevin Conroy still voices Batman sometimes. So it's not even like he left the character behind 20 years ago. He's still mm-hmm. doing the voice sometimes, and so it keeps that alive. So, I mean, I'd be happy to have him be a recurring character on the show until the show ends, but something tells me that's why I was surprised when he came back to Earth, mm-hmm. because it's like, it seems sort of weird to have a recurring character just be like Jean's wacky space dad who doesn't understand how Earth works. Like, you could get a little bit of humor, a little bit of pathos out of that, but I would have just expected them to leave him on Mars like they did with Miss Martian. You can go back there or have him appear again eventually, but when you bring him to Earth, it sets the expectation that you're going to see him. Jean's continuing story will be helping him integrate with Earth.
Yes.
And I didn't think that was where the show was going to spend a lot of its time. I didn't see where that goes, aside from like some wacky My Favorite Martian kind of like, oh, sure, Earth culture is strange. How do I eat this food? What is this weird music? You know,
it's Kofi, right?
But if this is where they're going with it, and I'd be sad because it probably means the character isn't going to make it to the end of the season. But it's a poignant way for him to go out. I did find it funny that a bunch of the characters that were singing in this episode are actually incredible singers, but weren't able to show it. Like, we know that, I'm completely blanking on the name now, the actor that plays Wynn, but I do know it, but I'm blanking on it right now. We know he's an incredible singer from the musical episode.
Yes.
And Carl Lumbly has a beautiful singing voice too. He sang in that one Justice League episode. The song that he sings on Christmas morning when he's sitting there by the window in his true Martian form, sort of mm-hmm. stroking the cat.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them really had to pretend to be tone deaf
terrible,
in this episode.
Do you know anything about Alex's character? Because she butchered that song so
I don't know whether she can sing or not. No, I don't know.
She did a fantastic job. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so I enjoyed that one. So Flash, this one was called Lose Yourself. So, I mean, the big thing here is that it seems like Ralph dies at the end when Thinker takes over his body.
Mm-hmm.
So I have multiple thoughts on this. One, I think that they have an out built into it, that the fact that Thinker wants his body is because his cells are so malleable that his brain can A, withstand mm-hmm. the expanding intellect of being the Thinker,
right,
and B, he can shapeshift into his old Neil Sandilands played version of himself.
Yeah. Super awesome.
But inherent in that is the fact that this body can control what happens to his own cells, including his brain. So you're like, does that mean that if given the right impetus, the right stimulus,
mm-hmm.
that his brain could reform into Ralph's brain and he'd be Ralph again? Like, probably. Like, this is all crazy make-em-up science, but within the reality that they've established, if one can become the other, then it can go back again.
Yes.
Right? Things aren't normally just plastic in one direction. So that should be possible. It lets them... And lets them put like an I don't want to say a real actor, but an actor with a bit more range into the role of the Thinker, mm-hmm. being now Hartley Sawyer, who plays Ralph, even though who only played Thinker in Ralph's body very briefly here before he morphed into the original actor again.
Yep.
But even just in those couple of scenes, he did a better job mimicking the speech patterns and conveying the presence of the original actor than any of the other day players. The bus metas that he infected, you know,
yep.
Fiddler and whatever the guy with the mental powers, you know,
yep,
the African American character from earlier, he did a better job there, and I was like, oh, cool. Now they're actually really smart because they took one of their regular actors who we know is really good, and he's going to be playing the Thinker now. And how hard will it be for Barry and the others to go up against him when it's got the face of their friend who they failed to save, right?
Right.
But now he just morphed into the original guy again. So I'm hoping that there's some back and forth there. Like, we get to see Hartley Sawyer play the evil guy again and have, because I mean, you just know that at the end, like, Barry's going to have some choice where he can, like, defeat the Thinker, and he's going to morph back into the face of his friend, and Barry's going to be like, no, I can't, you know, or at least that'll be the intention. So I'm hoping we see more of that. But but if we get the original guy back as a result of all this, and I think that that's probably worth it too, because he's apples and oranges. I don't want to say he's like a better actor than the actor that plays Ralph, but I think he's created that role, and he's better in that role than any of the other people since. So if they can get that original guy back in there, then mm-hmm. that's probably for the best. But mm-hmm. I still want to see more scenes of Ralph's body being, you know, with the Thinker's mind.
Yeah.
What do you think they're going with the Harry is becoming addicted to the Thinker's helmet thing? Because there was a moment or two in earlier episodes where they're like, oh, you know, we've got ourselves another planner. And they're mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, just like Thawne. And Harry's like, yeah, just like Thawne. And I'm like, are they setting us up for, like, Harry? I mean, I don't know how you get there from here. I mean, I don't know how you get Harry making himself super smart to him becoming, like, some new Reverse Flash or something. But do you think that they're setting us up, not just for him to become, like, but for him to, like, become Thawne in a way? You know, like...
No, I don't think he's going to become Thawne in any way.
I don't know how you do
that. But I do think that he is going to have, like, an evil transfiguration, because that's exactly what happened to the Thinker. And the thinking cap and the dark matter combination is what made him evil over a longer period of time. And I think that the same thing is going to start to afflict Wells. And I even foresee some sort of a solution that they thought of for taking down the Thinker, which they then have to have like one dose of, and they have to make the choice to apply it to Harry to save him instead. And so they're back to square one with dealing with the Thinker. I bet you that's one of the storylines that they're going to try to do.
Part of me does wonder if they do something to get, I mean, they've shown with the crossover, this year's crossover, that if they want to put Tom Cavanaugh in the Reverse Flash outfit again, even though it doesn't really make any sense for him not to be played by Matt Lesher, if it's the present version of Reverse Flash, they can just do it and say, oh, he's wearing his old face because he feels like it, right?
Yep.
But part of me wonders if they're doing like some long-form storytelling where he's going to become like some new version of the Reverse Flash or something. Because I feel like, I don't know, maybe they don't want to do any more evil speedsters. But I'm just thinking of, they had a couple of lines in an earlier episode where they're like, oh, you know, this is just like Thawne. And Harry's like, yeah, just like
There's Thawne. Also another... I don't know. There's also another solution that I thought of too, and the probability of them doing this is less likely, but it's still on the table, where Harry becomes incredibly smart and figures out the solution, but it's almost like a death sentence for him because he is afflicted the same way that the Thinker was, but instead of using his powers for evil, he's using his powers for good.
But that's how they ended last season with a Harrison Wells sacrificing himself to defeat the villain. Remember? That's how HR went out.
Well, I mean, they do a lot of self-sacrificing in all these episodes. It would be different,
but I'm not sure how many consecutive seasons you can have with the same actor playing the same, basically the same character sacrificing himself. That was the big emotional payoff of the last season finale.
Yeah, that's true.
Because Iris didn't end up dying. It was he was the one that sacrificed himself.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm not sure they would do that. So Black Lightning, this was the season finale.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought this was a good season finale. Yeah, it was a little different than I expected. I expected it in some ways to be more conclusive. Like and other ways to be less conclusive. Like I thought it was an odd note to end it on, where they kind of defeat the ASA, and then it turns out it's not really the ASA. It's a rogue operation being run by racist man there.
Yeah.
So they defeat them. Gamby shoots him, so I'm like, okay, that's fine.
Yep.
And then they have Tobias Whale there with something he got from the ASA, and he's like, oh, this is going to change everything. I don't know, like, I'm glad that they didn't kill Tobias Whale or put him in jail or whatever. And I read an interview with the showrunner, and he said, yeah, like, we're going to have new villains, and there's going to be new threats and stuff, but we see Tobias Whale as being, like, he's not, like, a one-season villain. He is a character on the show.
Right.
And so he might be there for the whole run of the show. He might not be, but we have no plans to, like, give his character a definitive end in the way that they did to Reverse Flash or Zoom or Savitar or anything like that. I mean, they, as if it's the same people. It's not. The show is run by completely different people, unlike all the other shows. But so I'm glad they're not getting rid of him. I just thought it was the show ended so definitively in so many other ways. Like, it almost could have been a final episode of the show. Like, oh, the family's together and they're happy and all their names have been cleared and they're living in their old house again. Yep. And they're running down the street just like they did in the first episode. And Jefferson and his wife are back together, and his daughters have both accepted their powers, mm-hmm. you know, to varying degrees. And they've kind of forgiven Gambi, and...
Yeah.
But then it ended, I don't know, it's just a weird note. Like, if you want to use the final shot of the episode to set up a cliffhanger, like, oh, here's this new threat for next season, that's one thing. But to just have the regular villain, who you've seen in, like, every episode so far, just open a box, that, to me, like, that's like, trying to be a mystery cliffhanger, but I don't really care what's in that box that much. We haven't really been given much reason to care that there's something incredible in that box.
Yep.
So, that to me, that was just an odd note to end on. But I did really enjoy the rest of it. I thought that was a cool showdown in the forest there. I enjoyed seeing Jennifer... use her powers more.
Yeah.
I enjoyed seeing her. We actually kind of saw her lightning form a little bit. Like, they could still see the actress under there, but she was, like, covered in electricity in the way that she kind of... In the comics, she basically looks... I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. You don't know what Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt looks like. She basically looks like a living lightning bolt. Like, she has a humanoid form, but she's, like, glowing yellow the whole time, and she, like, her features are very indistinct, you know? Mm-hmm. You know when they used to do the Human Torch?
Well, they did it once in this. You know when? When she charged... When she hugged... Well,
that's what I'm referring to, but you could still see the actress under all the CG lightning. She hadn't become, like, pure energy. It seems
okay.
to me.
Well, in the comic, she
kind of,
energy, but
in the comic, she kind of becomes pure energy in the way that, like, if you've seen, like, old Fantastic Four cartoons or the old Fantastic Four, you know, the super
when
old
Johnny
movies,
when
he becomes a human torch
and
you can't even see the actor under there anymore, it just looks like he's a humanoid fireball.
Yeah.
That's kind of like what she looks like, except with lightning.
Cool.
So it's, so like, but I think that's probably what it's going to, because they're not going to have her become CG all the time, probably on the show when she uses her power.
Not.
So it'll probably just be like a lightning effect that envelops her, like a, like mm-hmm. an energy field around her. So that's close enough. And they did, the producer did say that, yeah, she's going to be suiting up next season, probably earlier than you might expect. So it might even come back after the hiatus, and she might even be already fighting crime with them. Although there might be a few more episodes in there to kind of bring her to that point, but it's not going to be like a super long thing. So I enjoyed all that. They did set up... The one cliffhanger that I am curious about is when they said, oh, like, there's four beta subjects who are in the pods who are still in danger, but they're not, like, as far gone as the people in all the other pods, and so we can move them to an alternate location or whatever. I still think... So I told you last week that or the week before that I had a suspicion as to who was in one of those pods, and they didn't do it in this episode, but I still think that Grace, the girl that Anissa...
Oh, yeah.
Was sort of
that's
hanging
right.
out with.
Yeah.
Is in one of those pods.
Oh, boy.
Because in the comic, she is one of the outsiders. In the comic, she's an Amazon, but they're probably not going to do that on the show, but she's super strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if they want to do that.
Isn't Anissa also super strong?
Yeah, but in kind of a different way. She's not super strong in the way that, like, Wonder Woman is. She's super strong in the sense that she can, like, control her body's density. And,
right.
But she has to consciously do it. She's not just, like, invulnerable all the time, like Superman or Wonder Woman are.
Okay. Or Grace Choi.
Right. Well, she's an Amazon. She's as invulnerable as Wonder Woman is, basically.
Yeah. That's cool. I didn't know that.
Otherwise, I don't know why. I mean, aside from the fact that they were an item in the comics, which I guess is enough reason to have the character be named Grace in the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels to me, if you're going to name her Grace in the show, then why not go full hog? You know, go full hog and make her if not a superhero, then give her powers also. And it opens up the opportunity to have anybody could be in those other tubes. It could be other... It's going to be anybody. It's probably, like, other outsiders from the comics. I don't know if, like, Metamorpho is going to walk out of there or Geo-Force. They could probably do... They could maybe do Looker. They could maybe do Halo. There's some characters they could do that are more obscure outsiders from the comics, but it'd be cool to see them in live action.
Yep.
They actually kind of hinted at Geo-Force in a way was in... an early episode of Arrow, because they kept... Remember their early seasons of Arrow? I think that was where Malcolm Merlyn had his earthquake machine shipped from, was Markovia, which is the country that Geo-Force and Terra are from. Like, Geo-Force is the prince, or king, depending on, of Markovia, and, like, the scientist working on the earthquake machine in the first season was named Brian Markov. And I'm like, oh, is that Geo-Force? And then he was, like, promptly killed by Malcolm Merlyn. So, anyway, but it doesn't mean that he can't also exist on this Earth, or whatever, if this is a different Earth.
Right.
We still don't even know. Yeah, so I don't know. What did you think of this one?
I really liked it. I liked seeing, like you said, I liked seeing Jennifer get more comfortable with her powers. Desperation made her blow up almost and recharge her father's batteries. And then she was more deliberate about it when she defended her mom against getting shot. And then she threw Mr. Racist Guy up and down the room over there, which was fun and well-deserved.
Oh, and we got names for, so we found out more of the deal with, we got a bit more color on some of the villains too, right? We found out that, I think we might have gotten a name for Cyanide before, but now we learned a bit more about her.
Yep.
That she'd been like mutilated, she was rescued by Tobias Whale, but then kind of surgically mutilated by him to put like armor under her skin. And so she's now super crazy now because of that experience.
Yeah, but that was before that too, because he was conditioning her to be a killer before that.
Sure.
And that was just the final
and we
step.
Got,
that was just the final
God,
stage.
I cannot
remember. Lala.
Khalil, oh, right? Oh, I did it. Painkiller, I guess, is his name. So I want to now look up and see if Cyanide and Painkiller were the names of Black Lightning villains in the comics. I don't recognize either one, but I don't think I've, aside from the super modern stuff, I don't think I've, like, I haven't read any of the old, now I'm blanking on the guy, Tony Isabella. I haven't read any of the old Tony Isabella Black Lightning stuff, any of the original stuff. So if they were, I know Tobias Whale is his classic villain. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that, but I don't know if Painkiller and Cyanide are from that or not.
Well, that'd be interesting.
They kind of have a weird chemical motif. Right, and Tattoo Man. I'm like, is he going to be tattooed? So Tattooed Man, and in the comics, it's Tattooed Man,
tattooed.
Not Tattoo Man.
Okay.
And there have been two of them, but the original was a Green Lantern villain. His body was covered in tattoos, and he could, of all sorts of crazy things, weapons, mythological creatures.
Oh, and he could pull them off of his skin.
And he could tap each one, and it would become real.
Oh, wow.
But
you told me about that.
So sometimes, depending on like the artist, I think it would either become real or would still look like
an
sketch. It would still
render.
Look like ink,
oh.
But it would be like have all the solidity and effectiveness of the real thing. So you wouldn't be being attacked by like a real-looking tiger. So you'd be attacked by what would look like someone's drawing of a tiger come to
but
life.
But it would
you
be,
know?
Yeah, but it, I understand yeah. you.
And then there was
it's like an episode of The Mask.
Then there was the second Tattooed Man. Who, what was he created for? I think he was created in Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run, but then he ended up doing some stuff in Final Crisis. He was actually an honorary Justice League member for a while, and then he got roped into Deathstroke's own Titans team. It was a weird...
What was
weird
his shtick with tattoos?
He was the same. It was the same motif. It was just a different guy.
Oh, you
guy.
Could tap on the tattoo and make
Abel
it
Abel Tarrant, I think his name was. I can't remember the name. Or was that the first guy? I can't remember. No, Mark Richards was the second guy, wasn't it? Abel Tarrant was the first tattooed man? I can't remember. So I wonder if this is supposed to be the same guy, although this is, I mean, not the same guy,
it's
but
a
I wonder if
pattern.
They take on the same character. I'm not quite sure how effective he'd be in a battle, though. It's
yeah.
like, I can, instead of bringing to life an awesome tiger or a tank to fight you, he gets haunted by the spirits of the people that killed him.
I'm
that's
saying.
Not so good as a superpower.
Yeah, is what
and
I'm
that
saying.
Was, that is something I was a little unclear on. Why did Tobias Whale go to all the trouble of resurrecting this guy? Does he have, what special skills or influence or abilities does he have that made him worthy of investing all that time and money into him?
Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean,
it wasn't made clear yet.
He had a pre-existing position of leadership within the 100.
Right.
But why, like, he never seemed like even the most, like, stable or reliable or trustworthy guy.
Yeah.
Like, Tobias Whale didn't have anybody else he could prop up and put Khalil in that position now,
yeah, no
right?
Kidding.
He probably, like, he's easier to control and he's not crazy.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know. Like that was a little strange. But, I mean, at least it's kind of cool that we're seeing, like, a little villain team form under Tobias Whale. That's interesting.
Yep.
And they each have their own formidable powers in the way, except for the guy whose power is being haunted by his victims.
Hmm.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So, and then lastly, Arrow. So this one was called The Dragon.
Nice.
This was I always like it when shows do little off-format episodes like this, like the Lower Decks episode of TNG that focused on the crew members that you never see that... You know, and,
yeah,
and so you don't have any scenes that take place on the bridge, really, because these characters don't know what's going on in the bridge.
Right.
And they have to learn about it third hand. Like, oh, I found out from a guy that I was serving in 10 Forward that he heard from Riker that we're actually going to the demilitarized zone. And, you know,
right.
I always enjoy episodes like that on these kinds of genre shows, especially when they get into their late seasons and you've gotten super used to the main cast. So you shake it up.
You were saying
bit.
This would have made a better episode in the beginning to front load to make.
Well, the episode itself.
A better case for who this person is.
The episode itself would have stands on its own merits either way. I just think that it would have been more effective as far as setting up Diaz as a threat. I mean, obviously, we were supposed to underestimate him, think he was just some drug runner, some hired muscle,
yep.
until he kills Caden James. But once he does that, it's clear that now he's the big bad for the season.
Yep.
And so I think that's when you want to, that's when the audience is hungry to learn more about him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the best time to help the audience understand him and sort of empathize with him,
right,
so that now you're more drawn into future scenes that he's in.
Right.
But by having him revealed as the big bad and then not really do much except toy with Oliver and make evil threats,
yeah,
for like half a dozen episodes, and now with only two or three episodes left in the show, left to go in the season, now you give us his backstory and make him an interesting character. That seems weird. Like, you could have done, no reason you couldn't have. You could have done this exact same episode.
Yeah, but they were too busy focusing on
just rewrite the Oliver
Laurel,
and Felicity
though.
Scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even Laurel's scenes in this episode would have worked four or five episodes ago, right? Because she's been, her character hasn't really done much in the last four or five episodes either. She's been hanging out on Quentin's couch pretending to be good, right?
Yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
hasn't changed. All you would have had to do is excise or rewrite the Oliver Felicity scenes that dealt with him firing her, and you could have shot the exact same script.
True.
So I don't know why they didn't do that. But anyway, on its own merits, it was a really effective episode.
I agree.
I don't think they needed to be quite so heavy-handed with the whole Laurel is willing to do terrible things, but she's not quite as evil as she wants to be thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've hit that bunch of times already this season. And then this episode, they had one or two shots early on of her kind of like flinching or looking away from horrible things that were happening.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's clever. Just like do it subtly like that.
Yeah.
But then they got more and more obvious over the course of the episode that she was having problems
issues
with the stuff he was doing, to the point where actually at the end she was practically pleading him not to burn that guy alive, you
yeah.
know. So like, it didn't need to be quite so obvious with that. We get it. She's conflicted, you know. But
yeah.
But overall, and his story, it's interesting. I think it almost all comes down to Kirk Acevedo's acting.
Oh yeah.
Because
good.
He doesn't display a huge amount of range as the character, but he has such
strength.
Well, he exudes, he's got like this weird kind of machismo charisma.
Mm-hmm. But
charisma,
well oiled.
Machismo?
Though.
I'm not
so
sure what you call
like,
it.
So you could see part Lex Luthor in him, and you can definitely see the person that would like punch a person to a bloody pulp.
It's interesting you say that because I always remember a quote Clancy Brown said, the way he played Lex Luthor was as a cultured thug.
Hmm. Perfect.
Like he likes to pretend that he's above doing all these terrible things, getting his hands dirty,
mm-hmm.
but he would absolutely do them and enjoy them if given the chance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is not every version of Lex Luthor, but it was the way Clancy Brown chose to play it, with this very erudite voice,
mm-hmm.
but still this, I pulled myself up from the bootstraps and I had to do a lot of horrible things to
mm-hmm.
do it.
And I'm not ashamed.
I like to pretend that stuff is all behind me now. I like to pretend that I'm just this elite man of culture now,
yes.
But he's only like one bad day away from reverting to that. That's, anyway, digression. That's why one of the best episodes of Superman the Animated Series is Ghost in the Machine, where Brainiac kidnaps Luthor and has him, hides him, confines him to the lab in the basement of LexCorp and has him construct
this.
Him a new body.
Yep.
And so over the course of the episode, Luthor becomes like he grows this stubble and he hasn't eaten, he hasn't slept.
Yeah.
And he's
sweaty,
like, I need food and rest. And so Brainiac like blows up this vending machine
mm-hmm.
so that Luthor can get something to eat. Luthor runs over and starts stuffing his face with the candy bars until
yeah.
he catches his reflection
in the broken glass
and sees like these bags under his eyes and unshaven and his clothes unkempt and like
mm-hmm.
chocolate or whatever smeared in his face, and he can't even stand to look at himself. He looks away. I always love that shot because it's like he has done so much to make himself into this elite businessman, man of culture,
mm-hmm.
that he doesn't even want to think that he's like a normal person with normal needs and urges
mm-hmm.
and
he doesn't
and
want
problems,
to remember what
know?
He had to do. He just
exactly. He likes
wants
to
be far
he likes
away
to pretend
from
like he's
he
divorced himself
yeah.
from all of that. Like
yeah.
he's, he even like
well,
likes
in that
to,
version,
I'm not capable of that anymore. No,
yeah.
but you know that he would be, right? And then
oh,
of
yeah.
course, you know, later on, Justice League, he's flying around in a war suit, firing kryptonite blasts at people. So he's definitely, that version of the character is definitely capable of mixing it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, how do we get on? Oh yeah, Ricardo Diaz. And I think that's very true. I was actually going to make that same analogy that what Clancy Brown said about Lex Luthor, I think is true about him as well.
Mm-hmm.
A cultured thug,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
Like he's
intelligent.
He is what
scheming.
He is what that other guy,
yep.
Jesse or whatever it was. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he's a jerk, and I hate bullies as much as anyone. But you know, sometimes they got you pegged. You know, that the worst bullies are the ones that hit you in a way that you know there's some truth to it. You
mm.
know. If they make fun of you because, you know, you're secretly gay and you haven't told anyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like saying, oh, you know, you're, you know, whatever. And they're using whatever derogatory term. And it stings because you don't want to admit those things about yourself.
Mm.
Or if they call you a nerd and you know it's true because all you do is read books. Or they make fun of you for not being any good at sports. And it's obvious you're really not any good at sports, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the worst times, if a bully says, oh, you're stupid, but you know you're not. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt as much because you're like, no, I'm not, right? Like,
yeah.
If you can achieve any distance from yourself at all, you know it's not true. But the things that bullies tell you that hurt the most are the ones that have a grain of truth in them. And this guy had impact, right? He is a loser.
Yeah.
He's always been a loser, and he'll always be a loser.
Mm-hmm.
He's done all these things to build himself up and build this criminal empire. But what's the first thing he chooses to do with all that power is get revenge on a guy that can't even remember he exists.
Right.
Like, I thought that it's a little cliche that Diaz becomes this powerful man and the guy that tormented him is living this mundane blue collar lifestyle I've seen that before. Like, a guy comes back after he becomes the king of the world, he comes back to get revenge on his tormentor, and the tormentor is living this incredibly.
Yeah, so, I mean, Black Lightning did the same thing with Tobias Wade.
Right, it's very similar to that. And so I've seen that before, but it's funny because you look at it, it was actually quite effectively done here because of Diaz's character, and you look at it and you're like, he's doing this because he thinks he's finally become the king, and now he can get revenge on this guy that's now beneath him.
Mm-hmm.
But objectively, you look at it, and you're like, this guy is, for all that he was a bully when he was a kid, this guy is... has made more of himself than Diaz ever will. All Diaz has done is kill and steal and cheat and make the world worse. This guy at least has got a couple of kids to his name, right? He at least is giving back something to the world. And, and we don't know whether he continues to be a jerk like he was when he was a kid.
Yeah.
But I feel like the way the actor playing the adult version of him played it is he's the kind of guy that like has a lot of regret over the things he used to do when he was a kid. Like, he's actually become a decent guy like bullies sometimes do. And I thought that was effective. That
I thought so too.
And by showing that, but the interesting thing about Diaz is that he's reflective enough to kind of understand that about himself. Like when Laurel tries to talk to him, and he's like, "No, I always think about Jesse. Like, I'm always thinking about him." Right? Like, he's like, "Oh, that kid doesn't matter to me anymore. I'm way beyond him now." No, he knows he's not, right? Like, he understands enough about himself to know that this guy is under his skin and always will be. And so he kills him in the end, but he probably doesn't even derive that much satisfaction from it, because in the end, like, this guy won, right? This guy changed the entire course of his life and made him into this murderer.
Yeah.
And then this guy goes on to live a perfectly normal day-to-day life with a wife and kids and a job and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's interesting, and it was well done, and Kirk Acevedo played all the scenes with the exception of the one scene where he smashed his hand into the mirror there, with sort of like barely restrained fury.
Yes,
like I don't know.
I actually really liked this episode, including that scene where he smashes the window, because it seems so calculated, and he's. I think one of the neatest things a villain can do is express patience and calculation in service of achieving their long-term goal, and in the face of adversity such that anybody else under those same circumstances would crack and, you know, throw something and ruin the entire plan and sort of just lay all their cards on the table. And he's taking it like a champ. He pre-calculates that wannabe gangster mob boss junior there was going to turn on him, and so he's wearing a vest. That was calculating. That was a pro move, you know. And then at the same time, he, you know, takes his time and bides his time before he lets himself punch that little punk in the face.
It was a little strange that they introduced, just in this one episode out of nowhere, the idea of this organization, the Quadrant, which they say controls all organized crime in the entire country. I'm like, wait, does Oliver know about this? Flash know about this? Like, where did this come from?
Are they AKA the Ninth Circle, which is a reference to the comics?
And they did not seem terribly interesting or effective either. Like, there were just four guys sitting at that table, only two of which were actual actors, because the other two were just sitting there not doing or saying anything because they weren't paid to have any lines.
Yeah.
And the one woman does, it was super obvious, should have been super obvious to everyone in that room, including the dozens of armed guards, that Diaz was going to shoot that guy.
Yeah.
And yet everybody let it happen.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, like, to me, it's like, I don't know why, like, I understand from the context of the episode why they would let him take a seat at the table, but I think in reality, like, someone who'd done the stuff that he'd done, you're like, no, you're way too unpredictable and murderous.
Yeah,
we're not going to let you join our group. Like, I don't think that would ever happen.
Exactly.
But in a way, it kind of works the theme of the episodes, that it was almost too easy, because he, you know, like, he's...
Well, I could buy it on a trial basis,
he doesn't really care about them or having a seat at the table in and of themselves, like on their own merits. He doesn't care about that. He only cares about it because it's the next rung on the ladder.
Status. He's got to
get to the top of the ladder,
yeah.
Or else he's nothing. You know?
Exactly.
He's got to keep climbing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought it was a really good episode, and it's like I said, it's smart of them to give this character more depth, and I think the actor was definitely capable of it. It's a long burn though, because they introduce him 10 or 15 episodes ago, like very close to the beginning of the season, and he seems like he's going to be a one-off.
Yeah.
Drug lord boss, just part of like Diggle's whole
addiction storyline. I think it's the first time that they've done an episode like this where you follow. I mean, Oliver Queen was on screen for maybe 2 seconds, but this is the first time where we really followed the villain in this way. I don't think there was an episode where
I'm thinking back. It's sort of the
flashbacks
first,
is one it's thing, sort of the but first I mean, this, time. This is the entire episode.
It's the first time. Yes, first episode. I thought you were saying like this is the first time they've done an over the course of a season.
No,
setting
I mean,
up a villain in this way.
Because they've done Slade Wilson flashbacks.
Yeah,
what
I thought you were saying was it's the first time when we kind of were misled as far as who the big bad of the season was going to be.
Oh.
Because we knew pretty early on that Malcolm Merlyn was the villain of that season. We knew Damian Dark, Ra's al Ghul, we know they
sure.
were going to be Prometheus, right?
No, they had the little bad
the
big
closest,
bad
the closest thing
for the
is the Slade
time.
Wilson thing, where it wasn't until like the midpoint of the season that we knew that Slade Wilson was even alive in the present.
Right.
Was the one manipulating everything that was going on
yeah.
in the present in Star City and had revenge and was out to get revenge on Oliver for reasons we didn't even understand yet.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the closest, but yeah, they never quite done a swerve like this, so that was definitely interesting. And he is a different villain than the other villains we've had before, because, I mean, I guess maybe the closest would be Slade Wilson, just because Manu Bennett plays him with sort of like a man of the people grumpiness,
right.
I mm-hmm. guess you could say.
Yeah.
But Malcolm Merlyn, Damian Dark, Ra's al Ghul, even Prometheus to a certain extent, all sort of consider themselves to be superior and elite
mm-hmm.
compared to everybody else
yeah.
around them. And
yeah.
even Deathstroke too, to a certain degree, when he was all hopped up on Mirakuru, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Diaz is much more of like a scrappy underdog type villain than we've
had
before.
You know what else they've had, they have in common is that they have prior history with Oliver Queen specifically. And
I'm running through the list in my head.
Well,
I mean, we saw Ra's al Ghul's yeah. first interactions with Oliver in that season. We saw Damian
yeah.
Dark's first interactions with Oliver in that season.
Mm-hmm.
He had run afoul of their organizations previously.
Yeah.
But Malcolm
but,
Merlyn
I mean, he,
and Slade Wilson were the ones that came to that their
town.
Seasons with years worth of backstory.
Yeah, I guess my point is that they walked into town knowing who he was and targeting him
yes,
specifically.
That's been true for 3 out of 6
whereas
cases.
Whereas Diaz is more like I'm gonna take.
Well,
what
and
I
even
want.
Ra's al Ghul and Damian. I guess Damian Dark would kind of be the closest in as much as he didn't like even Ra's al Ghul, who didn't have previous dealings with Oliver Queen, targeted
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
Like, I want you to be my heir stuff, right?
Exactly.
Damian Dark was kind of the closest we've come to someone who came to town and knew he'd probably have to deal with the Green Arrow, but that's not why he was there. He was just an obstacle
yeah.
in the way, and he
yeah.
kind of enjoyed playing with him and messing around with him a little bit, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that would probably be the closest, but yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I'm enjoying the season.
Me too.
Maybe not as much as last season, the Prometheus stuff. I thought near the end was especially strong, the
mm-hmm.
way it really broke down Oliver's character and then kind of built it back up again, the way that they mirrored and brought everything full circle in the flashbacks.
Yep.
This season isn't really built to do a lot of that full circle stuff that I always find so satisfying, so
right.
it can't really be that.
Yeah.
But I think they've done a good job forwarding the characters and doing interesting new things with the characters and introducing interesting new characters and having a villain that is different yet still interesting.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same
that's
thing.
It for our shows.
Well, that's a good batch of shows. And if you would like to reach out to us, we have an email address, mailbag@smartspodcast.com. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. Our Twitter handle is @smartspodcast. And our Facebook page is facebook.com/smartspodcast. How about a funny sound for us?
I can't think of one.
How about that?
Was that a whip?
No, it's a punch sound effect.
Oh, okay.
Oh.